Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I am grateful to the individuals who support this program by subscribing. People like Diane Morris, Steve Wozenski, Aaron Blair, and Raymond Welch. You can do it too if you haven't already. The details under my mugshot on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a podcast that went well beyond my original intention. Peter Van Buren, the State Department whistleblower who's been my guest here many times, wrote an interesting story recently about a federal air marshal turned whistleblower named Robert McLean. So I lined up an interview with McLean, whom I'd never heard of, and I forwarded Van Buren's story to two other whistleblowers, Joe Carson, who still works for the Department of Energy at the nuclear facilities at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Julia Davis, who was fired from Homeland Security and faced incredible retaliation for trying to warn superiors about a pattern of suspicious people crossing the border at San Diego. So Carson responded with criticism of McLean's lawyer, Tom Devine, of the Government Accountability Project. Davis replied with a copy of an article that she wrote in 2011 that questions McLean's credibility and motives. Frankly, I was surprised by the level of antagonism among whistleblowers. So I proceeded to interview McLean and Devine, and you'll hear that unedited in just a moment. What you'll hear is McLean's story, and after that, I asked him to respond to the critical article written by Julia Davis. I also asked Tom Devine to comment on Joe Carson's views. So then, in fairness to Carson and Davis, I invited them to talk with me for this podcast. Davis sent a written statement, which you'll hear at the start of segment two. Carson agreed to talk and invited an attorney and fellow whistleblower to join us, David Pardo. Pardo is a persistent critic of GAP and Tom Devine. To get informed responses, I sent audio of the McLean-Devine interview to Davis, Carson, and Pardo. Without my knowledge, Pardo quoted from the unpublished interview on his blog even before I'd ever talked with him. This caused McLean to cry foul, suggesting that it was unfair to me for me to share the unreleased interview with the others. Now, I disagree. It's the only way for Davis, Carson, and Pardo to know what was said and decide how to respond. So here come both interviews. Nothing has been deleted from the comments of any of the people you're about to hear. I think I was pretty fair to all the parties, but you can decide. Please give me your feedback after you've heard the whole exchange. You can email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. Or if you think I'm unfair, use an alternate address, fullofit, at peterbcollins.com. And be sure to follow the links in the show file to the various articles and websites that we refer to. My bottom line is, I'm concerned about the way the government retaliates against honest whistleblowers. That's my main focus. But since these other issues came up, I think it's only fair to air them and to do so fairly. Thanks for listening. On this program, we have talked with numerous whistleblowers over the years. And as you know, the Obama administration has presided over an unprecedented and sweeping crackdown on whistleblowers. Most prominently Bradley Manning, but in almost every government department, there are people who know something and want to say something, but they are being deterred by the treatment of people who have walked that walk before them. Today we're going to look at the story of Robert McLean, a former federal air marshal who blew the whistle when, for budget reasons, they decided to cut back on deployment of air marshals at a crucial time. His attorney is Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, one of the major whistleblower advocacy organizations in Washington, D.C. Tom has assisted in over 5,000 whistleblower cases dating all the way back to 1979. Tom, does your whistle ever get so wet it doesn't work anymore?
Actually, it does sometimes, but not very often.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And before we talk to Robert McLean, tell us how you first found out about his case and, in general, how people do connect with the GAP, Government Accountability Project.
Peter, I think it's mostly through word of mouth and referrals from other whistleblowers whom we've helped. It's a very active community that keeps in touch with each other, and they figure out what are the resources that are possible or available. There's not that many, so it's not that hard to find us. Sometimes they get in touch with us because they're referred by congressional offices or inspector general offices, sometimes because there's been a story about one of our clients that's been spotlighted in the media.
Mm-hmm. And Robert McLean, did you ever think you would become a whistleblower? You served in the Air Force, at the Border Patrol, and then back in 2001, you joined the FAMS, the Federal Air Marshal Service.
Well, actually, I was in the very first class of air marshals to graduate right after the 9/11 attacks. So I actually joined the FAA's Federal Air Marshal Division.
Okay.
Which would eventually turn into the big TSA.
Right. And that there was all this reorganization, because it started under the FAA, and then TSA was created as a subset of the newly created monster agency, the Department of Homeland Security.
That's correct.
And so did you ever imagine that you would be called a whistleblower?
No, as a prior law enforcement officer and a current law enforcement officer, I blow the whistle almost every day. So this is sort of part of my duties.
Okay.
I hate to label myself as a whistleblower, because I think there are low-level people who are not in a law enforcement capacity that that deserve a lot of protection. But as far as police officers and law enforcement officers, this is sort of our duty.
Mm-hmm. Robert, set this.
I do want to clarify, though, that
he's
covered by the whistleblower protection laws, whether or not that's his personal identity, and that was the point of his lawsuit.
Okay. Well, we'll get into some of those details in a moment. Robert, if you would, take us back to July of 2003 and set the scene that led up to your receipt of a text message essentially telling you that air marshal missions were being canceled for cost-cutting reasons.
Yes. Already for a year, the Federal Air Marshal Service had a mandate that we pre-board before the passengers very overtly in front of the handicapped or families with children. We were mandated to have a dress code policy that required, at the minimum, a suit and tie. There was a military grooming standard. So there was already, we already had the problem of the agency wanted us to be very visible to the public and everyone flying on the aircraft. So in July, in late July of 2003, we were called to every air marshal in the country was called in to attend emergency one-on-one briefings inside their field office, where they had to have this briefing done face-to-face. And the alert was that they discovered an Al-Qaeda plot where they were going to exploit an immigration visa screening loophole to and sneak weapons onto an aircraft, overtake the crew, and fly the aircraft into East Coast European or Australian targets, primarily cross-Atlantic flights and long-haul flights.
All right, and so this was not what they called chatter. This was not a nonspecific threat. This was a pretty well detailed, at least at the state of investigation. This was not something that was just a fuzzy notion that there might be something somewhere.
Absolutely. That's why they did not put it out over email, over text message. It had to be inside a secured building. And for almost 6 years afterwards, the Bush administration had made the memo, you could not FOIA it. So it was when I initially FOIA'd the warning, it was completely redacted until 2009 when it was declassified or whatever.
And you're referring to the Freedom of Information Act and the verb to FOIA.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
That's correct. So two days after we had this emergency training, the agency put out a unrestricted text message, had no markings or classifications or any designations. They put it out on an open cell phone text instead of sending it to our encrypted communication devices that we all had to cancel our hotel reservations in order to avoid cancellation fees.
All right. So let me recap here. You've been told there's an imminent threat, a very specific one, and then just days later they say, never mind, for cost-cutting reasons, we want you to go home and wait for us to call you.
That's correct. Everybody thought it was a mistake. I called air marshals from around the country that I knew. Everybody thought it was just, somebody made a mistake. It was a clerical error. And this open broadcast was just a mistake. So I called our field office and spoke to a duty officer or duty supervisor who confirmed everything and said there's nothing that can be done at the field office level. It was a national plan that was done at headquarters. There was no more money in the budget, and they couldn't afford to have air marshals on nonstop long-distance flights for two months.
Now, according to the article that I learned about you from, our friend Peter Van Buren, the State Department whistleblower, if you will, he says that you also complained to the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General. Tell us about that.
So after I spoke to my supervisor, I called there was a central line to make Inspector General complaints. So I spoke to, I'm assuming I probably spoke to somebody on the East Coast who asked where my location was. I told them that I was in Southern Nevada. They referred me to a San Diego office, called there. They said it was an audit office. They couldn't help me. And then they referred me to a criminal investigation office in Oakland, spoke to a special agent, and he pretty much nicely told me there was nothing that really could be done. He understood the problem with the air marshals. He flew armed so he would see us very obvious. So pretty much I felt I hit a brick wall after that.
All right, so you were confronted with a choice here to live within the bureaucracy, just shut up and hope nothing bad happened, or to risk your job and the warnings that, if you disclosed internal information that you could be fired. You decided in balance that the safety of the flying public against this known threat was more important than your own butt. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And at that point, it was pretty lucrative. It was ludicrous that what was going on. So there was still, even the Inspector General special agent was confused and probably thought it was a big mistake also.
Mm-hmm.
So it was surreal.
All right. So
hard to believe.
What did you do with this information? What did you decide you needed to do?
I chose a reporter that had been working on a lot of air marshal stories with NBC News. So he was familiar with the agency, with a lot of problems that were going on, especially the ridiculous dress code and pre-boarding requirements. So I chose him, and he confirmed it with air marshals around the country and also said he was coordinating with leaders in Congress and said he was going to be issuing a story as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. And before we go further, Tom Devine, is this kind of an all-too-typical situation where a federal employee who has access to critical information has to make a judgment about whether to play along with the rules, keep their job, maybe get promoted, or to rock the boat in the interest of permitting, you know, this person to do the job that they were hired to do?
Well, that's one of the core contradictions that every whistleblower or would-be whistleblower has to resolve when they're at that crossroads. Do I risk everything in order to fulfill my duties as a public servant, or do I abandon the public and just look out for number one, but make sure that I'm honoring my priority to support my family and declining to engage in an act of professional suicide? There aren't any good choices mm-hmm. in that situation when someone is facing as high stakes, almost apocalyptic of a breakdown as Robert McClain did. And this is one of those rare moments when, as an individual, we really do have an opportunity to change the course of history, but at a horrible, horrible price. And after people make these choices, their lives are never the same. Whichever way they decide, for better or worse, they'll always be different.
Now, Robert, in this first episode in 2003, you were not discovered as the source of this information that did make it into the media. But about a year later, you went on television in some sort of a disguise, and you criticized what you had just raised a few minutes ago, the dress code and how obvious you were when you boarded a plane. And you thought that was a bad policy, a bad idea. And apparently your voice was recognized by one of your coworkers or someone in the agency, and that led to all of the legal problems that you're still working through. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. After my disclosure, everyone in Congress went crazy, and it quickly got reversed. But a year later, NBC Nightly News asked me to come on for a post 9/11 special on what has changed and what has not changed since. And they did a segment where I discussed the procedures that were just outing us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the agency was perfectly happy with it. The agency believed that we were high visibility deterrents that would scare away potential hijackers. They would later admit to that because their policies were just so obvious.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you differentiate between the two issues? Because, you know, from my perspective here, and I'm detached, all right, I'm not trying to totally second-guess you, Robert, but it strikes me that the initial leak to the media about the stand-down for cost-cutting reasons at the time of a very specific threat seems much more significant than the issues of the policy related to the dress code and whether essentially you were undercover or easily identified on a specific commercial airline flight.
Well, eventually the Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, which was Republican controlled at the time, forced the agency to stop these procedures. So they eventually stopped with the dress code and the pre-boarding procedures. But when Internal Affairs came to interview me about being on NBC Nightly News, they asked me why NBC Nightly News approached me, and I told them that I had been a source for them on other things, and that's when they asked me to provide all of the information on my prior contacts with them. And I pretty much knew that that Internal Affairs would probably be making me provide all information, because if you're not completely upfront with in an administrative investigation, that can be held against you as not being upfront, and mm-hmm. That can also be held against you. So they did not. None of the charges in the end stemmed from my appearance on the TV show. The one charge that they used to eventually terminate me came from my July 2003 disclosure about canceling long-distance missions.
Understood. And Tom Devine, when you look at this from a legal perspective and from the way they retaliate against whistleblowers, I regard the first disclosure as critical and the second one as more of policy infighting. And in my experience, the policy infighting leads to greater retaliation, because a lot of this, the layers of secrecy that are applied are about avoiding embarrassment or political firestorms, not really about the mission of the agency or protecting national security.
Yeah, you're touching on that point is so significant, Peter, because the initial ruling in Mr. McClain's case got right down to what is the role of an individual in the government. The administrative judge started out with the premises that Mr. McClain was acting in good faith to better protect our country. The judge second concluded that he had succeeded in his goal. The judge third concluded that the only disruption to the agency was the administrative burden of correcting the mistake when the agency said it was going to mistakenly abandon the country during an al-Qaeda attack. Nonetheless, the administrative judge said this was a fireable offense because as an individual government employee, he was taking actions that changed the authority and the choices of agency management, and it's their authority to decide how to spend their resources. And even if it means abandoning the country, the principle of management control rather than individual frontline employees having a voice trumped the public policy priorities. It's almost surreal to me as a citizen that would be the case. There's also a dimension to the new Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which Mr. McClain's case really was, his experience was one of the foundations for our advocacy in Congress for these new reforms. And under the new whistleblower law, you are not protected as a whistleblower for debating about policy, but you are protected for disclosing the consequences of a policy choice. So while if you applied that back to Mr. McClain's scenario, he didn't question to MSNBC, he didn't say this is a good idea or a bad idea. His disclosure was sharing the evidence that the country was going to be abandoned. And that evidence of the consequences creating a substantial public safety threat to our citizens, that would have been protected under the new Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. And hopefully it will be under the prior law as well, because we're going back to finish his case.
Now, I'll be putting up a link to Peter Van Buren's detailed article about this case in the show file at peterbcollins.com, so you can review it for yourself. But one of the points that Van Buren makes is the incredible escalation in the amount of material that is classified. In 2011, 92 million government documents were classified. And we also have a problem of retroactive classification, where something that was public and was not initially labeled as secret can be arbitrarily recategorized as either sensitive. Van Buren points out that there are now 107 different designations for sensitive information in the government bureaucracy. The critical one in this case is that the TSA regards the information that it sent to air marshals as an internal SSI, which stands for sensitive. What does it stand for, Robert?
Sensitive Security Information, SSI.
Thank you. So tell me a little bit about the Hall of Mirrors here as information that had not been classified and that you did not reveal as classified information was suddenly declared to be sensitive, and therefore you were in violation.
Yes, sensitive security information, SSI, is an unmarking designation that's regulated by TSA regulations. The message that the agency put out had no markings. It was openly broadcasted. They had a choice to send the message with an encrypted password-protected communication device. It was a multi-million-dollar contract that the agency had for us to get classified and sensitive information. They chose to send it to our unsecured plain cell phones. So 3 years after the fact, the agency, and after I admitted to it, the agency designated it as SSI and argued that an unauthorized disclosure of SSI is a violation of TSA regulations, which is a violation of statutory law enacted by Congress and signed by the president. They also argued that I should have known better. It was a very simple article. They should have said, it didn't matter if it was designated anything. It didn't matter if it was sent unsecured. Mr. McLean was trained in identifying SSI material, and he should have known better to designate it himself. And that was so. Those two arguments they made to sustain my sustain that one charge and to uphold my termination.
Now, Tom Devine, let's get on the down escalator here, and as Condi Rice colorfully referred to it, head into the bowels of the bureaucracy, in this case at the Justice Department, where there is the little-known Merit Systems Protections Board. And as I understand it, this was created by the Civil Service Reform in the late 1970s, and the intention of the law is that the Merit Systems Protections Board serves as the appeal panel and evaluates these internal whistleblower claims. Can you shed a little more light on this?
Yes, the MSPB is the successor to the old Civil Service Commission that we had for over a century before the Civil Service Reform Act and post-Watergate scandal reforms. And it's been a fairly good outfit under the Obama administration. Its leadership is primarily composed of employee rights advocates before they took those posts. Unfortunately, though, the MSPB and a lot of the Obama administration seem to have kind of a blind spot when it comes to national security, getting into conflicts with free speech rights or transparency or seems like almost any other value the president stands for. If national security gets in the way, then national security trumps, it prevails and cancels out prior commitments or legal rights. And that's really, it's just really not acceptable. We do, however, have some good news, though, in terms of the problem that you were just asking, Robert, about ex post facto classification of unmarked information. Under the new Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, a whistleblower's rights cannot be canceled because information is classified unless it's specifically marked to give the employee prior notice. If it's not a document, they have to get oral notice. And that's spelled out pretty explicitly in detail in the law, and it's in part because of scenarios like Mr. McClain's nightmare. Also, about 2 years ago, President Obama, with many criticisms of and frustrations with about national security, actually took the teeth out of these 107 pseudo-classification categories, like sensitive security information.
Mm-hmm.
Under an executive order that he issued at the end of 2010, they cannot affect anyone's rights under disclosure laws or transparency laws. The termination of Robert McClain in 2006 actually wouldn't be legal to even start today.
And in, if you can just fast forward to sum up some of the legal action, the Merit Service Systems Protection Board ruled against him initially, you appealed it, and you recently got a decision in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in April of this year. Can you just detail that for us, Tom?
Oh, sure. In fact, Robert lost three times at the Merit Systems Protection Board. There is the initial decision by the administrative judge who, as we discussed earlier, said that he didn't know his place in the government. He was an individual affecting the judgment of agency managers, and it doesn't matter what the results were. There was an MSPB decision before that hearing, actually, that took the Whistleblower Protection Act out of the case. One of the final rulings of President Bush's MSPB chairman was a landmark precedent against whistleblowers in the McClain case, that agency secrecy rules had the authority to trump, to supersede, cancel out the free speech rights that Congress had enacted in the Whistleblower Protection Act. And that was just an apocalyptic development for whistleblowers. It made all their free speech rights basically an agency honor system. And when we appealed the administrative judge's ruling that Mr. McClain had it coming, we asked the new Merit Board under President Obama to reconsider that earlier decision and restore enforceability for the Whistleblower Protection Act. And they didn't do it either, Peter. They actually narrowed the Bush ruling so that they said, well, normally only Congress can weaken whistleblower rights. But here's a situation where Congress told the Transportation Security Administration to issue nondisclosure rules to protect any information that the Secretary of DHS thinks would be dangerous for the public to know. And even the Obama board said, well, Congress gave DHS permission to gag its employees, so that's all right. The Federal Circuit disagreed.
Mm-hmm.
They said that Congress can weaken the Whistleblower Protection Act, but only Congress can do that. And they can't give a blank check delegation to agencies to do whatever they want. The way the law is written is your free speech rights can only be restricted if there's a specific statutory prohibition. And in the end, specific was the magic word for Mr. McClain's victory. The Federal Circuit unanimously ruled that Congress had never with specificity said that the type of action that he was taking would be illegal. They just told TSA that they could issue their own secrecy rules, and TSA said pretty much anything that embarrasses us is dangerous to the country and illegal. And the court said that's not going to cut it.
And so the court ruled in Mr. McClain's favor, but nevertheless sent it back to the Merit Systems Protection Board for final adjudication?
Yeah, it's the conventional parts of the case after 7 years are ready to start. Whether he deserved to be a whistleblower, whether his dissent was well taken, and whether there was retaliation against him. But frankly, Peter, we think that's kind of mop-up. The Waterloo battle in his struggle was whether or not he was entitled to the Whistleblower Protection Act when he issued public warnings
mm-hmm.
of information that an agency had gagged. And the court said with an exclamation point, yes, he is. Under the whistleblower law, You're not protected, of course, for just emitting hot air or gossip, that sort of thing. You have to have a reasonable belief that you're disclosing serious government breakdowns that, in this case, would cause a threat to public health or safety. Mm-hmm. And there's really not much, there's not going to be much drama about whether he had a reasonable belief. First of all, just anyone with an IQ of over 50 knows that it's dangerous to abandon the country when you're under attack. And secondly, the government said it was a mistake, and they corrected it within 24 hours because of Mr. McClain's disclosure. The other thing you have to prove is that there was retaliation, but that's not really in dispute here because they officially fired him for mm-hmm. blowing the whistle. There's no pretext. So we're very confident about the end game.
So, Robert, what do you want out of this? You want your job back?
Absolutely. I can't wait to go back and serve, just like I've done since I was 18 years old when I joined the Air Force and probably until I was born because I grew up a military brat. I definitely want to come back and I want to serve.
And Tom, so, typically will they allow reinstatement or since he was fired, will they attempt a settlement with back pay and maybe a little garnish on top of that?
Well, he's entitled under the law to reinstatement. That's Mr. McClain's right if he prevails. But my guess is that the agency isn't going to be too thrilled about welcoming him back, so they might try to make it worth his while to find an alternative career path. But it's his judgment call, and it's his right.
Mm-hmm.
If he prevails, he gets his job back.
Now, Robert, as I mentioned, I've talked with numerous whistleblowers across many agencies over the years, and this is the first case where I got a little pushback from other whistleblowers. And I am not going to be coy with you or play gotcha, but Julia Davis was fired from the Department of Homeland Security herself. She has an amazing story of the retaliation that was visited upon her, including a helicopter with SWAT-type forces who landed at one of her homes and terrorized her parents. And so I was really surprised when she sent me an article which takes your case apart, and she basically takes the side of TSA and defines you as a leaker who should have known that the text message you received was an SSI. And she goes on to say that you made a seven-figure settlement with NBC News for the appearance you made that led to your termination. And like I say, I was kind of surprised to receive this. And I wanted to get your reaction to the assessments that she has made because she questions your motivation and your credibility.
Yeah, it was all false. And she never asked me for any response. She never asked for any responses from my attorneys. You probably have read it was a blog that she wrote. I tried to respond, and she had all of my comments deleted. So it's pretty difficult to respond to false allegations when you're not even given the chance to do so. I have a lot of sympathy for her case. She prevailed. And I wish her and all of hers the very best. It's too bad that we have whistleblowers that are crabs in a bucket and stabbing each other to death because the real problem is bigger than us. It's the government. It's the classification. It's overzealous bureaucrats. But I'm not going to get into I don't want to attack other whistleblowers. I believe everyone has a meritorious case, and it should be publicized. That's pretty much all I can say to that. I hope for her the very best, and that she gets the support she needs.
All right. And Tom Devine, do you have any reaction to the analysis that was offered by Julia Davis?
It was offered without trying to check the other side, get both sides of the story. And she's had a credibility problem within our community. She also opposed passage of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act to strengthen whistleblowers' rights. I don't know what's really motivating her, and I'm not going to speculate.
Mm-hmm. And that Whistleblower Protection Act, though, has huge carve-outs in the national security sector, doesn't it?
Oh, it's very frustrating for us is that the House Intelligence Committee said they would kill the whole bill, which they did in 2010. If there were the same rights for, if there were rights included in the law for employees in the intelligence community, that's like the CIA or the NSA, the FBI, or rights against harassment through security clearance removal, which is sort of the Achilles heel of free speech laws. It's a way to fire you without firing you. You just yank somebody's security clearance, mm-hmm. and then they can't do their job. And there was, we fought tooth and nail for those, but the intelligence community's bureaucracy is pretty much calling the shots for the House Oversight Committee, and so it's very frustrating. They wouldn't discuss the issues or their concerns either. It was just naked power play. But, you know, again, we've had a lot of problems with President Obama in some areas. He did the right thing here. He, through a presidential policy directive, through executive action, restored all the rights that the House Intelligence Committee had forced out of the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. He did that through executive action. They won't have as good enforceability because they're going to have to be implemented through regulations issued by the intelligence community, which is a conflict of interest. A future president could also remove them, but he did establish a landmark precedent, for the first time. CIA, NSA, intelligence employees have free speech rights within their institutions, which is where most all of them engage in dissent anyway. Very few spies are interested in public debate.
Mm-hmm.
That's a breakthrough. It's also illegal for the first time in history now to yank an employee's security clearance in retaliation for blowing the whistle. So we got some of that back, and I just can't finish answering your question without giving credit where it's due. This happened because Robert McLean and another whistleblower, Franz Gehl, hounded me relentlessly after the legislation was killed through a last-minute hold in, last-hour hold in 2010. It was procedurally killed an hour before Congress adjourned over this issue. And immediately, within a day or two, they didn't wait for the holidays to be over. Robert and the other whistleblowers said, President Obama can't be off the hook. He can't blame this scapegoat this on Congress. He could be doing all these rights himself. They wouldn't leave me alone until we launched a campaign for it, and the president responded to it. And coming out of his experience, he's helped to earn free speech rights for the entire national security community.
And Franz Gehl is one of the four people profiled in Robert Greenwald's latest film, The War on Whistleblowers. Tom, I'd also like you to react to some information and commentary that I've received from Joe Carson. And I can't imagine that you've never heard of Joe Carson. He is a prolific writer, and he has contacted many agencies and congressional committees and the White House over the years. He describes himself as a successful whistleblower in the Department of Energy, where he is a nuclear engineer in Tennessee. And he's been very active on these issues, and his central focus is on the Office of Special Counsel and the role that it has under the 1978 law in protecting whistleblowers. And he contends that there has been what he calls a broken covenant, this longtime failure to enforce these rules, and in particular for the OSC to exercise its appropriate role in protecting whistleblowers. And he starts with the contention that most federal employees don't even know about their rights under the Office of Special Counsel. So could you, I'm sure you've heard from him, so could you tell me your viewpoint on the issues that he raises?
Well, I hear from Joe all the time. relentless, and we actually represented him in some of his earlier victories under whistleblower rights at the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very familiar with his perspective. And there have been extensive periods of time when I completely agreed with him about the Office of Special Counsel. And, in fact, our organization tried to get the institution abolished. We thought it was a Trojan horse for whistleblowers. I don't think that he was really fair in giving credit where it was due with some of the special counsels who really did stick their necks out and work hard and get effective results protecting whistleblowers. Probably the area where we've really agreed to disagree the most is Joe has been attacking me for a few years. He used to be a big fan, but he's been attacking me because I disagree with him that we should sort of delegate the policies on whistleblower protection to the White House Office of Legal Counsel. He thinks that this would straighten things out for whistleblowers, and I've just been dubious because it's the same office that was behind the memos on drones and on legalizing torture, and every time we've learned about an opinion they've had on whistleblowers, it's been to shrink or abolish whistleblowers' rights. So we've agreed to disagree on that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And do you share his characterization about what he calls the broken covenant, that those who occupy the OSC have failed to operate within the law and to, you know, properly report on cases of the PPP, what is that, prohibited personnel practices?
Yeah, that's all the merit system violations. I think you just can't generalize, Peter. There's been some of the special counsels who not only broke the covenant, they tried to destroy it. There was a special counsel in the 80s named Alex Kaczynski who actually taught courses to federal managers how to fire whistleblowers without getting caught by his own investigators. He would tutor them in his office how to write up the terminations to fire whistleblowers.
Is that the Kaczynski who's now a federal judge?
He's the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't got caught by whistleblowers from the Office of Special Counsel, he'd be on the Supreme Court right now. There were 43 votes against his Ninth Circuit confirmation because of how he broke that covenant, betrayed the trust that he had as a protector of whistleblowers. Scott Block, the special counsel under the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
His sentencing for whether or not he'd go to jail was postponed yesterday because the evidence had been doctored about why he shouldn't go to jail. And he was such a horrible special counsel that he had to resign after the FBI raided his office, and he was covering up the evidence that they were seeking at it. There have been some people who just, they were magnets for whistleblowers by their own staff at the Whistleblower Protection Agency. But it's not fair to generalize. There's some other folks who've really made a difference. And, I mean, Joe and other members of the community, they're observers a lot of times of what happens. I have to deliver results for people whose professional lives are at stake. And I can tell you that right now, the Office of Special Counsel is working their tails off. And they're getting results for whistleblowers, and they have a lot of their leadership is composed of former free speech activists and employee rights activists their whole careers. It's not fair to say that one institution is always good or always bad. That's just not the way life operates. And right now, we've gone from warning whistleblowers not to sabotage themselves by filing complaints with the Office of Special Counsel. We've gone from that perspective 5 years ago to the Office of Special Counsel being the first option to help whistleblowers. And it's completely just dependent on the results.
Very interesting.
Whatever works.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting and a different perspective. And I don't want to quote this word for word, but essentially, Joe Carson, who you described as a former client, and you have disagreements now, but he makes the claim that your agency, the Government Accountability Project, is akin to an ambulance-chasing a personal injury attorney, and that you benefit from the failure to enforce the existing laws and the failure to pass meaningful whistleblower protections in the national security arena. So could I ask you to react to that?
Sure, I think it's a little ironic to be called an ambulance chaser from someone who we represented with that charge. That's just not anecdotal with Joe. We haven't charged for our time here at Gap for the first 33 years out of 34 that I worked here. And just in the last year, we started charging for the salary time, not making any profit. We're a nonprofit organization. We make it a point not to try to make money off of our whistleblowers' bank accounts. If we prevail in a case and the government has to compensate our attorney fees, that's a little bit different. But
you don't operate on.
I work for 5,000 whistleblowers, and I've never charged any of them.
So you don't operate.
I don't know what he's talking about.
You don't operate on contingency. Gap doesn't get a percentage of an award. Is that correct?
I think about 2 years ago, we switched so that we can get contingency awards. But, Peter, the laws for government whistleblowers, they may call remedies. People don't make a profit off of those awards. You can't have punitive damages. That's what ambulance chasers go after. Punitive damages is punishing the wrongdoer, and the plaintiff can get rich off of it. The lawyer gets a cut. The whistleblower rights laws that I've worked my head off to get passed and that we operate under, they make whole remedies. They mean that the employee isn't worse off than if they had remained a silent observer. They don't make any profit for us to get a proportion out of.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Tom, I appreciate your perspective, and I'm glad to get your comments on record here. And I just want to say that I'm not a whistleblower. I'm not a part of the community. But I appreciate that your organization and POGO and others are there. And even if some people feel the work that you do comes up short, you're taking on a real Goliath, often with fewer resources than David had. And it's gotten increasingly difficult since 9/11. And I appreciate that as well. Robert McLean.
It's just hopeless to please everyone, but it is such a treat. I think I'm one of the luckiest lawyers in the world. My clients are all Davids. They're all taking on Goliaths. These are the people who changed the course of history. And your other guest today, Robert McLean, he did that.
And Robert, what's your final comment here today? Would you do this again?
Oh, absolutely. I was born a warrior. I became a cop. This is what I like to do. And this couldn't have happened with almost 20 members of Congress that came to my aid, either directly or supported my actions, such as Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, John Kerry, and many others. POGO, the Government Accountability Project, the Office of Special Counsel, filed briefs on my case. This was a huge team effort, and Peter Van Buren's article was very well done. It was very in-depth, and I appreciate that. And you, Peter, I really appreciate you getting me on the record, especially with trying to clear rumors. So I'm happy that you brought it up, and I'm happy to address anything in the future that you think doesn't sound right to you.
Very good. Robert McLean, I'm glad to have you on the program today. Keep on blowing that whistle, and I'll see you on a flight sometime down the road. And Tom Devine,
absolutely.
I thank you for your time today and all the work that you've done.
Thank you, Peter,
for having us.
Segment 2 on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. You've heard whistleblower Robert McLean and his attorney, Tom Devine, of the Government Accountability Project. That's Accountability Project. And Devine in particular had some critical words of Joe Carson, who joins us next. some 80s punk from the Peter B. Collins Tax Deductible Music Archives. Yes, there is an archive, and yes, I do deduct. That's the Tom Robinson Band, Don't Take No for an Answer. And that's what I think of when I think of Joe Carson, who will join us in just a moment. He has been a successful whistleblower at the Department of Energy, and you heard the comments from Tom Devine of the Government Accountability Project. They have had some differences over the years, and we will attempt to fairly air some of that out here as we continue. I want to open this segment, though, by reading a statement from Julia Davis. She is the Department of Homeland Security whistleblower who wrote a critical article about Robert McLean, and they have been going back and forth. You heard McLean denying the analysis and some of the allegations that have been raised by Julia Davis. And she decided that she wanted to express herself through this written statement, and so I will read it for you. She said, "I'll be more than happy if the ruling in McLean's case helps the cause of whistleblowers. I certainly stand by everything I wrote as it was based on evidence and witness statements. And by the way, I will link to Julia Davis's critical article in the show file at peterbcollins.com so listeners can read and evaluate it for yourselves." She continues, "As far as Tom Devine's comment that I have no credibility because I publicly oppose the defective bills pushed forward by GAP and POGO, GAP is the Government Accountability Project, POGO is the Project on Government Oversight, I would reply that furthering such ineffective legislation impugns the credibility of GAP, POGO, and Mr. Devine as an attorney. The National Whistleblower Center was the only major whistleblower protection organization that acknowledged and opposed the shortcomings of the bills, which eventually forced some of the dangerous loopholes to be closed. As long as national security whistleblowers continue to be denied meaningful protection under the law, I will openly oppose any bills that fail to protect them. It's ludicrous to hand out transparency awards and to promote ineffective Trojan horse legislation while the whistleblowers continue to be prosecuted and imprisoned." Signed, Julia Davis. Joe Carson returns to our program today. He has been my guest before, and he frequently corresponds with me. He's been very active in trying to protect the interests of government employees who see wrongdoing and want to report it. And he also has been quite an articulate activist on the issues related to the 1978 civil service reforms that led to the creation of the Merit Services Protection Board and the role of the Office of Special Counsel in many, many functions, but including essentially monitoring the work of the Merit Service Protection Board. Joe is a professional engineer who works for the Department of Energy in its nuclear division in Tennessee. Joe, welcome back to our program.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a privilege again to be here and to have your attention and that of your audience.
And also with us is David Pardo, who Joe Carson referred to me. And I thought that since Robert McLean had his attorney, Tom Devine, with him, that it's fair to offer an attorney's perspective. And David Pardo is an attorney who worked for the Federal Aviation Agency. He left as a whistleblower, and in a few minutes I'll ask him to thumbnail his own case for us. But he also has been very active in the whistleblower community, and he operates the website mspbwatch.net. And it seems like you've got a web of websites, David. I haven't been able to catch up with all of them.
Well, there are a lot of websites and postings. I'm pretty active. But I just want to say thank you for extending the invitation, and thank you, Joe, for extending the referral.
And let me start with you, Joe Carson, because I did raise some of your issues with Tom Devine. And he acknowledged that he once represented you, that he hears from you on a regular basis. I thought he was fairly diplomatic in saying that on some issues, the two of you agree to disagree. I don't know if that's a mutual agreement, but that's how he expressed it. So if you would, take a moment here to talk about your own history with Mr. Devine and the Government Accountability Project and your perspective on his work.
Well, first, Peter, and
I'm sharing this because I know just how complex it is, but I'm going to be a nuclear safety engineer and be really, I guess I want everything described properly. It's the Merit Systems Protection Board, and believe it or not, that plural is significant, systems, and the Office of Special Counsel, and it's actually the other way. It's the Merit Systems Protection Board is supposed to provide oversight of the Office of Special Counsel.
Okay, thank you. It gets a little confusing for a guy like me.
Yeah, it's Congress created a complex system by which federal employees, as myself and as Dave Pardo was, are to be able to do our vital duties for the security and safety of this country ethically and competently without fear or favor. And it did that in part because it didn't trust the agencies themselves to self-regulate their management cultures. So it created some other auxiliary agencies that have got vital responsibilities for the regulation of the management culture in each and every agency. And those agencies are the Merit Systems Protection Board and the Office of Special Counsel. So to get back to your question, what's my role with GAP been? I became a whistleblower over 20 years ago about serious nuclear public safety and worker safety issues in the Department of Energy's nuclear facilities in Oak Ridge. And here I am 20 years later, still employed, still with a security clearance, you know, still married. It hasn't been fun, but a difference between my whistleblowing and that of others, and I'm not trying to disparage them or make me better, or I'm just saying it is a difference. I'm a licensed professional engineer, and as such, I am a mandated reporter in certain circumstances, regardless of possible employment retribution. And that means if I have responsibilities, my professional duties include workplace and public health and safety, and if my employer is not listening to my concerns, I have a positive duty to speak out to anybody who might. And if that means I lose my job, well, so be it. That's what's expected of a professional engineer. And that's because engineers, we build the contrivances upon which the public health and safety depends. So if push comes to shove, our ultimate loyalty professionally is to the public health and safety, not our employer. And that's why we in certain circumstances, are mandated reporters. So in my pushing through this for 20 years, I haven't just been, I'm defending my profession. And I was a professional engineer before I was employed by DOE. I'll be one when I'm done. I'm going to be a professional engineer. And if DOE succeeds in firing me, well, okay. I mean, when I chose to be a professional engineer, I knew that could be one of the consequences, you know, if I had a dispute with an employer. Okay, but to go back to the Government Accountability Project, I became aware of them in the mid-90s. And in a sense, you can see I've been all the way through the cycle with them. I became a source of insider information to them because the systems within DOE were blowing me off, so I went to the outside to GAP. And they, they publicized it, made some differences, but, and in fact, they testified as to all how the information I provided them, they used successfully at a lot of nuclear safety campaigns. And that is kind of GAP's business model, which goes back to this Office of Special Counsel. The Office of Special Counsel is supposed to be the primary way that federal employees of any agency can make disclosures of wrongdoing in that agency. And it's one of the two or three legally authorized ways to do so when that information is classified or cannot be publicly released. But if the Office of Special Counsel is not working as a disclosure channel, is not being trusted as a disclosure channel, then concerned federal employees are going to more likely go elsewhere, including third parties or good government groups such as GAP. And I'm not disparaging GAP's role, but I am saying there can be a tension between GAP saying if the Office of Special Counsel was really working, we wouldn't be as necessary, vis-a-vis them feeling more necessary and then having that inside information which they can then trade for access and influence with the media and Congress. And then the Government Accountability Project gets the majority of its funds from just a relatively few foundations, so that the GAP needs to have its name in the paper regularly, so their foundational grants are approved.
And GAP's budget is about $2 million a year. It seems to be about two-thirds coming from major foundations.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, and I want to clarify what Tom Devine said. And he never was my attorney. GAP represented me, but it was not Tom Devine. And this is in the mid to late 90s. And at the time, several people told me, GAP attorneys, saying that, and it's 15 years later, I'm trying to get the tone right, if not the exact words, but basically people like me could readily become basically bullets in Tom Devine's gun, that he has an agenda and the individual whistleblower was basically to be, used or not, to advance his agenda. And that could be, is an ethical issue there. When if you're an attorney, you're supposed to be zealously advocating for your client. But if you're an attorney for an advocacy organization, where's the line between looking out for your client mission? And I think Tom Devine has erased that line, and it's just basically about what he perceives as his mission. And if you are the client of Gap, if you had to be sacrificed to advance the mission, well, in his point of view, it's good for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I can put, and now let's go to Bob McLean's case. And I'll try to make this, try to keep it clear, but I'll try to, make how I feel Tom Devine disserved Bob McLean as his attorney. Okay, and I'm saying this publicly. I'm a professional engineer. And if Tom Devine wants to disagree, I invite him to file a professional misconduct complaint against me with my licensing authority, because as a professional engineer, I have to make public statements in a truthful and objective fashion. That's in my rules of professional conduct, and I wish to be held accountable to it. Okay, so Bob McLean is a federal air marshal in 2003, and he gets information, over in a non-secured way about cancellation of coverage for federal air marshals on flights.
Right, he got a text message on his personal phone.
Right. Now I've had conversations with Bob McLean. Okay, we've been around this pond for a number of years, and when he got that, it wasn't like, oh, this is non-classified. It was also a thought of, did they screw up and send me classified information in a non-secured way? That's one reason that he disclosed the information the way he did, anonymously to the media. Now, another reason is because when he went to his IG, they didn't take any action. But it was in a context where he was unaware of his statutory right to legally, TSA had dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's, and said, this is SSI, and it came over his secure beeper, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even if they had done that, he still had the statutory right to go to the Office of Special Counsel and say, this is a substantial and significant risk to public health and safety. We're on a higher, an elevated terrorist alert, and they're going to cancel our coverage. He did not know that. He did not know he had the statutory right to go to the Office of Special Counsel. And not only did he not know it, but the Office of Special Counsel probably would not have received it anyway, because they were not set up, even though they have the duty to receive such disclosures, I don't think they have the people with the clearances too, mm-hmm. at least back in 2003. So what should have been the case in 2003, and if Tom Devine and Gap had been doing their job for the last 30 years, or at that point 25 years, 20 years, it would have been that Bob McLean knew he could go to the Office of Special Counsel, and he knew that the Office of Special Counsel would be an effective disclosure channel, and that the Office of Special Counsel would take action to get this concern, if it had to identify it up to the president to get fixed. So he would not have to go to the media, talk, in silhouette, and then go through the last 10 years of his life. The system should have, that's how the system should work. And it doesn't. It didn't work then, and it doesn't work now, as indicated by the Benghazi situation.
All right, but Joe, let me interject here, because in your shoulda scenario here, I understand that most federal workers are probably not aware of their rights to make a protected disclosure to the Office of Special Counsel. That said, it is widely believed that the system is broken. And you acknowledged in your own comment a moment ago that they don't seem to be, or at least in 2003, they were not prepared, not set up to receive these kinds of disclosures. So we've got a feedback loop here that at least tends to explain in hindsight why a guy like McLean would go to an outside agency like GAP. Because most people recognize that system is broken. Now, he may have been ignorant of all of it, but once he sought some sort of professional outside help, wouldn't they have acknowledged the same failure at OSC?
Well, yes, okay, but this is 2003, so it's 25 years after the Office of Special Counsel was created. Gap touts itself as the nation's leading advocacy group for whistleblowers. So shouldn't Gap have been identifying this 30, 25, 20 years ago? This is nothing new. This has been status quo since day one at the Office of Special Counsel. And getting it fixed? It should not be me talking to you, Peter, in 2013 saying the Office of Special Counsel has never fulfilled the statutory duties as the primary disclosure channel for classified information in the federal government. That's with the intent of the Civil Service Reform Act. And Gap has not said boo about that in 30 years. So I have to say, well, why not? And you just heard Tom Devine yesterday. He wants to get rid of OSC. Well, I guess that's good job security for him. But, Peter, should I be saying, I'm a nuclear safety engineer, and you know what? I really want some people to take some of this irradiated material and kind of grind it up and spread it around the neighborhood, because that's going to make work for me and my tribe. You know, I want this, you know, I'm here to protect the public health and safety. Gap and Tom Devine in particular, they project themselves as people that are out protecting the public health and safety. Then they should be the ones ensuring that OSC is scrupulously is complying with its duties and has the resources too. The Office of Special Counsel has 110 employees for a workforce of federal workforce of over 2 million. It has always been grossly under-resourced. And you heard Tom Devine say it. He wants it to go away. Well, you know, he's been, there's no record of the Government Accountability Project or the Project and Government Oversight or these good government groups ever saying, this Office of Special Counsel is grossly under-resourced. It should have 400 to 500 people to be credible. Right?
Now, Joe.
I hear your, you know, it's a feedback loop. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about the bigger picture here, because I don't have any feeling that I need to defend Gap or Pogo. But I do understand the nature of this work, which is very difficult, particularly in the national security sector, where the tools and the resources available to the government dwarf even a well-funded individual who can hire one of the Cone brothers, the well-known whistleblower defense attorneys, to represent them. And so it's a very uneven playing field to begin with. And yet, my sense is that you, and we'll get to David Pardo here in a moment, but that you seem to assign outsized expectations of what they can do, both in a positive and negative way. In the emails you've sent me, you essentially assign a role to Tom Devine as if he is the go-to guy for the government when they want to compromise the whistleblower community. And on the other hand, you seem to have the expectation that he should be able to represent every one of, he estimates, 5,000 clients over the last 30 years in the, you know, the most aggressive way that anyone would want an attorney to represent them in. So I'm caught between these competing expectations and my own sense of the degree of difficulty that any whistleblower support agency faces in taking on a case like yours.
Well, let me, I appreciate the feedback, so let me try to clarify. I have been patrolling the halls of Congress. You described me properly as relentless. I'm repeating to you what so many people on the staff of Congress and in the media who cover the Federal Civil Service have told me, which is get Tom Devine to agree with you because he can drive the media interest and the congressional interest will follow the media interest. I have to give Tom Devine credit that everyone kind of has branded him as the, you know, the subject matter expert for federal whistleblower law and policy.
But he then defaults into a position as the lead lobbyist for the whistleblower community. And I understand that the so-called reforms to whistleblower laws that were drafted by Congress and then some imposed by executive order come up way short and in some ways appear to be a ruse. That would cause some people to make disclosures that then could, lead to dramatic retaliation. I think that I have appropriate skepticism about any idealistic approach to this situation. But my sense is that on the one hand, You expect Tom Devine to be able to single-handedly fix some of these things. I'm oversimplifying. And on the other hand, you fault him when he isn't able to single-handedly achieve what is needed.
Well, I think I disagree with the second part. If the system worked, people don't need Tom Devine at the Government Accountability Project.
Okay.
I should never have had to call up a private sector attorney to deal with my issues.
But the system doesn't work.
The system failed.
Joe, the system doesn't work. We know that.
Okay, and what I'm sharing is the reason that the system doesn't work is look who benefits from the current broken system.
Okay.
And I will put Tom Devine in the people who benefit from status quo. So he will say, we need to fix some things, but not the things that, when they don't work, benefit what he perceives to be his interest or the interest of the Government Accountability Project, i.e., that a Bob McClain didn't know that he could, you know, and I'm saying a federal, just say a federal employee in general. Mm-hmm. Why are we in 2013, 35 years after the law was passed, assigning the Office of Special Counsel the primary role of being the classified disclosure channel for federal employees with access to classified information, and it doesn't work as that. And no one in Congress has ever taken it to task, and no one in the media has ever taken it to task for failing or connected that failure to the intelligence failures or the other, you know, the other classified information failures that have occurred in the government for the last 35 years.
All right, Joe, I want to take some time now to talk with David Pardo. Again, you can visit the website, one of the websites he's involved with, mspbwatch.net. And David, take a moment here just to thumbnail your own case. You were working for the FAA, and you were ordered to release some information, or I guess some new regulations related to how long people work and what their physical condition is, their appropriate condition to work, and that you refused to sign off on this because they had not permitted public comment. Is that a quick thumbnail of what led you to blow the whistle?
Yeah, that's about right. I joined the FAA in late 2009, and I was there for about 6 months before I was asked to release a memo, an interpretive rule of one of our pilot fatigue rules, without required public comment, notice and comment, which was in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act. Now, at the time, this was in spring 2010, it was about a year after the crash in Buffalo, New York, of Colgan Air Continental Connection 3407, mm-hmm. where 50 souls perished. And so there was a big push, a big emphasis on fatigue issues, because that was, I believe it was a contributing factor in that accident.
Yes, both the pilot and the co-pilot had remarkable work schedules and commute schedules that left them clearly vulnerable to diminished capacity because they hadn't had enough sleep.
That's right. And I recall the there were reports that the co-pilot was commuting from Seattle to the East Coast, you know, and sleeping on the plane overnight and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I looked at the proposal, and I knew that, you know, the FAA doesn't have all the answers. That's why, it, you know, the law requires the public to weigh in. And I said, no, I'm not gonna sign it as is. And initially, my boss agreed with me and said that this was just, you know, that she forgot to tell me. Well, 3 weeks later, they issued a twin memo. There were two separate rules that were really about the same thing. One was about mechanics, the other one was about dispatchers. And that letter, identical, was issued without notice and comment. And so that was in violation of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that happened, after, you know, they gave me assurances that I was simply mistaken, I knew that retaliation was around the corner, and it was. I got a bad performance review, and then there were some shenanigans with other work, pretext, things like that. I was let go in September 2010. Now, this is a pretty open and shut whistleblower retaliation case. It's not that interesting. But what I was clued in on, the insight that I had at the FAA during the months of, you know, the retaliation and the duress and, you know, all that pressure, I realized that nobody in the agency knew about whistleblower laws. I didn't even know. I had to discover everything for myself. I went to the Office of Special Counsel. I went to the Office of Inspector General. I tried contacting, or I did contact, my congressional representative, and all of it was for naught. It didn't stop the retaliation, didn't stop the termination. But what I realized in exploring the legal issues is that for a law that's been around for about 33 years, since 1978, the Civil Service Reform Act and then the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, it was, as a legal matter, as an attorney speaking, it was
remarkably underdeveloped. There wasn't a lot of awareness of it. There wasn't a lot of case law. And when you compare the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, which George H.W. Bush signed, with a law that he signed 1 year later, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, who doesn't know the ADA, but who knows of the WPA?
Mm-hmm.
And so that told me that we've got a problem that extends beyond the FAA, and it probably has to do with regulatory capture. And that's something that I'm very familiar with as a regulatory attorney.
And describe that. Define that for an average person.
Regulatory capture basically means that there is a system, an administrative system in place of laws, of rules, you know, of government agencies, and that the regulated entities have found a way to game the system to benefit from it at the expense of the public interest.
All right, and I'll offer an example that I talk about regularly here, which is here in California, we have what I call the rogue utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, and their former executives and cronies from other utilities are on the Public Utilities Commission that regulates the utility, and we have a big issue here where gas pipelines blew up, and this Patsy Commission is setting up the penalties for PG&E so that they don't actually pay a fine. They pay penalties that can be deducted from taxes. So they're going to pay $2.25 billion, but $900 million of that is tax deductible. And it's that sort of thing that I think is a good example of a regulated industry that controls its regulators.
That's right. And I think you can make, I am in complete agreement with Joe Carson. I think you can apply that theory, that doctrine, to the Government Accountability Project, to the project and government oversight, et cetera. And I'll tell you something. When I spoke up at the FAA and I said, no, I'm not going to sign this, as a lawyer, I should have had the freedom to do that. And instead, I was met with what is essentially tyrannical behavior, you know, crushing a dissenter, silencing a dissenter. After I got fired and I got involved with the whistleblower community, and you know, we're a pretty rowdy bunch. There's, you know, we've all had traumatic experiences, and you know, we're used to a little bit of chaos. But what I didn't anticipate was that in getting to know Gap and getting to know Tom Devine and working alongside him trying to pass legislation, at some point his answers, explanations didn't really add up. And at some point, this was about a year ago, when myself and a few others, we were tasked with exploring, researching issues related to the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which passed last December.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote an open letter to Congress identifying six areas of needed reforms to make the bill better to remove poison pills. And these are six areas that Tom Devine himself identified and suggested to us. He requested that we write this open letter. And then we did it. We did the research. And he must not have expected us to do a good job or a thorough job, because when the time came to submit this open letter, to publicize it and send it to Congress, he said no. He didn't want us to go ahead with it. And he said basically that it would result in congressional staffers essentially be feeling insulted, and that we need to give Congress a pep talk not to meet their action or inaction with criticism, and that we should essentially defer to the frontline lobbyists like himself and others in a coalition that he assembled, and that we should defer to their judgment. And we said no. No, you know, you don't defer to a lobbyist. The lobbyists in Congress work for the people. And so that basically created a rift in my relationship with Tom Devine.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened my eyes. And what I saw from him, the way he reacted to our letter and to that dissent, he basically acted in behavior very reminiscent to what I had experienced in the FAA, essentially trying to crush a dissenter's silence. You know, there were smear campaigns, whisper campaigns, et cetera. And the things that Julie Davis talked about, I had experienced myself. I know others who have experienced it. I have it documented on my website. And I'll tell you, the whistleblower community is not a very healthy place.
I have to say I'm learning that. I've talked to a number of individual whistleblowers over the years. My friend Sibel Edmonds started the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and so I have talked sometimes with her, sometimes solo, with many whistleblowers. But as I pointed out in the earlier part of this podcast with Robert McLean and Tom Devine, this is the first time where I've seen such sharp and detailed criticism by a whistleblower of a different whistleblower. And yeah. I was aware, you know, I know that there are whistleblowers who are aggravated and who have a very good cause to be disappointed about the way and the manner in which their cases were handled. And I know Sibel Edmonds would not object to my describing her as very unhappy with our legal system and disappointed in various ways with those who at one point did advocate for her. And she's also bitter, I don't think it's unfair to use that term, about the response of the congressional oversight committees and the other committees that have handled this legislation in really their arrogant determination not to really honor the claims of whistleblowers, instead following the prevailing winds of supporting the expansion of the national security state at virtually all costs. So I am aware of the differences, and I wouldn't expect that this vast and varied array of whistleblowers would all sing from the same hymnal, the same song every Sunday. But the thing that I want to push back on, David Pardo, is again somewhat the expectations, and also, do you have any sense of deference to Tom Devine for the fact that he has been doing this work for 30 years and that he's been through various administrations of various shifts in party control on Capitol Hill and the very significant sea change that occurred after 9/11 in both public attitudes and those of our legislators? And so, sure. You know, I understand the arguments that you raise, and I think that on the face they have validity. At the same time, I do have some sense that Tom Devine is an honest guy who is not simply an ambulance chaser trying to take advantage of the latest whistleblower.
Okay, well, listen, I mean, I do have respect for Tom Devine, and I think this is a point that Joe Carson raised. Most of the time, Gap, Pogo, Tom Devine, they're great watchdogs, except when the government failures happen to benefit their business model. And I'm not expecting Tom Devine to be, you know, a Green Lantern or a White Knight. What I do expect is if somebody comes forward, you know, in the community with well-founded concerns, there should be, you know, a mechanism, a way for those concerns to be channeled up. And there isn't. And that is because I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Tom Devine is the person that Congress defers to, is the person that appears most often in articles about whistleblower issues. You know, he has captured the market, and he is not exercising the unparalleled power and influence that he does have in a manner that is consistent with the public interest. And you see it when the responses that he has to Joe Carson are not, or to myself or to Julie Davis, are not based on reason. They're based on ad hominem.
And
David Pardo, as I'm listening to you, I'm also looking at your post at mspbwatch.net with 21 reasons why, you know, you think Tom Devine should step down. And it begs the question, do you think you could do a better job if you were suddenly given the level of influence and authority that you attribute to Tom Devine? Is that something that you want and that you would use in a different way?
Okay. I don't want to be Tom Devine. I don't want to be at the top of the hill. What I do want to create, what I'm trying to create with MSPB Watch, is an infrastructure where citizen activists can come forward and get together and spot issues, raise the flag, get contacts in Congress, do it in a transparent, accountable, reasoned manner. I'll tell you, Joe and I don't always see eye to eye on everything, and that's nobody expects that, but we do agree that the system is broken. And I want the community to work well enough so that somebody like Joe Carson can come along, raise his concerns, do his research, draft other people together, and you know, they come up with a report, they come up with a letter, and that report, that letter, would make it, you know, to the relevant congressional committees, and that committee would look at it and say, you know, this is meritorious. What happens now if things are done behind closed doors? I'll give you a perfect example.
Right.
In 1978, when Congress drafted the Civil Service Reform Act, this was the landmark legislation that Jimmy Carter campaigned on, they held about 4 to 5 weeks of open sessions, markup sessions, conference committees that were transcribed. There were hearings across the country. And I have all the most of that. I went to the Library of Congress a number of times. I live in the D.C. area. And there was a real give and take in these committees. Now, fast forward about 34 years. This is last October. And you've had the committee, the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, which was chaired by Senator Joe Lieberman and Senators, I believe, Susan Collins. And Joe Lieberman opened the session and he introduced the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012. And then he gave the floor to Senator Daniel Akaka of Hawaii, who read a five-minute statement, and then the whole committee voted for the bill, and that was it. So compare 5 minutes in 2012 with about 5 months or so in 1978. Now, the amount of work, it's not that there was less work, although there might have been a little bit less, but all that took place behind closed doors with staffers and lobbyists, and Tom Devine was the lead author of the bill. And when we came forward with concerns, there was no guarantee that they were going to be addressed or listened to or debated. And so when Julie Davis says that there are loopholes in the bill, well, if you don't have a transparent process, who's to say whether the issues are going to be aired, advocated, et cetera?
Well, and let me just react to that because I wasn't there, and I don't pretend to know all of the details. But we have had a major shift, as you just pointed out, that so much of the work that used to be openly debated is now done on K Street and over napkins and cocktails in Georgetown. And then it appears on the Hill, and he's sometimes just attached to a conference report coming out of nowhere. I'm referring in this case to the Monsanto Protection Act that was recently rammed through. And so we have had a shift, and when you add the veneer of national security and the fear and hysteria that's been generated since 9/11, the kind of narcotic effect of being sworn into black programs and having the authority to vote on legislation, I think has left a lot of our elected leaders in the pocket of the people that they're supposed to be overseeing. And I would single out my senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Intelligence Committee and is willing to trade away all of our Bill of Rights protections, privacy protections, and the oversight role of the Congress in many of the so-called secret programs, including drones and surveillance, that have mushroomed in this country in the last 10 or 12 years. So that's a long-winded way of saying that I don't know the extent to which Tom Devine did the best he could under difficult circumstances, or, as you tend to suggest, is you know, too compliant, perhaps, with the prevailing winds, and, you know, tries to navigate as best he can. So I hear the issues that you raise, and I appreciate that you and Joe Carson have put this in a reasonable, rational context so that people can attempt to evaluate this for themselves. But my bottom line is that I care about whistleblowers, and I care about the way that they have been retaliated against in a dramatic increase, a much more aggressive way, under the Obama administration. And that tends to cause me to say that I don't expect miracles from an agency like GAP in a context like this. Let me turn to Joe Carson to react to what I've been discussing with David Pardo. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, well, I'm an engineer, or I'm going to come across as an engineer. But what's the point of passing new laws when existing laws can be ignored with impunity for 35 years? And I think it just becomes, a ruse. For 35 years, the Office of Special Counsel was supposed to be the primary way that federal employees could effectively, Peter, not just go to the Office of Special Counsel that went, I checked that box, but it would do something, okay? Mm-hmm. It would do something to protect the security of this country. It was called upon by a concerned employee. That function has never worked, and Tom Devine is perfectly happy with it being that way. So that's why it's me talking to you now about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's 35 years. It's nothing new, and it's not that Tom Devine's not aware of it. I think you're not mentioned to your readers, but I hired independently. I hired a Yale-educated attorney who had clerked for a federal judge, and I asked him. His name is Loring Justice. I said, Loring, you are not my advocate. I want your best professional opinion. Here are the laws. Here are the facts. What do you think? And he found that all my concerns are at least reasonable, if not compelling. And again, I've been trying to get my concerns resolved. They're really just all about disputed law for a number of years. And, you know, I could look at it two ways. I'm not going to blame Tom Devine that Congress and the media and the White House have informally outsourced federal whistleblower law and policy largely to him. But they have. Okay? And whenever I speak to people about it, the thing that comes up so often is get Tom Devine to agree with you and then things will happen. And Tom, as you just heard on your show, he has no intention of trying to get things fixed. So if he becomes the obstacle, then I have to put my relentless efforts into discrediting him or getting him out of the way so that these concerns, which, again, are not just my concerns, Dave Pardo is an attorney. He's agreeing they're reasonable. Loring Justice, a Yale-educated, law school-educated attorney, agreeing they're reasonable if not compelling. And it's the president that ultimately we describe in the Civil Service Reform Act. Because Congress created this complex system with a lot of moving parts, it made the president responsible, I'm quoting, to take any action necessary to make sure this system was working, because Congress didn't want agencies to self-regulate their management culture, so it gave the president the ultimate responsibility. I'm trying to activate him, and it's I'm sticking my neck out to do so, but you know what? The stakes are enormous.
Well, and Joe, you do stick your neck out, and in some cases right now, you're kind of daring the Obama administration and Attorney General Eric Holder to take your bait. And I respect that you are using every available means to try to draw attention to, and you have persuaded me. I find you not only relentless, but quite persuasive that the law as it was intended has not been followed all of these years, and that there is a wink and nod series of understandings among those responsible to leave it the way it is. And if you infer that that then benefits Gap and to some extent Pogo, I think you are entitled to that view. Let me ask you each to just offer a final statement here. In podcast land, you know, we have unlimited time, but we have to respect that our listeners may not have unlimited attention. So I'm not curtailing this out of any effort to cut off the discussion, but just in the interest of making this accessible to our listeners. So let me start with you, David Pardo. If you'd offer your summation, I'd like to hear it.
Sure. I think that the system can work if we just adhere to pretty timeless constitutional values or values that that were derived from the Constitution: due process, transparency, and following the rule of reason. Once you do that, then you can expose bad faith arguments and you can expose agendas. But I think once we do that, that will go a long way to creating a community, a system, a government that works to identify problems.
All right. David Pardo, thank you very much. And Joe Carson, your final comments, please.
I took an oath as a federal employee to uphold the Constitution, but also to well and faithfully discharge the duties of my office. And to well and faithfully discharge the duties of my office, not just me, but the other 2 million federal employees, we have to be able to effectively voice concerns, particularly when they cannot be publicly disclosed. We have to be adequately protected from reprisal and other types of prohibited personal practices. And we need to have some objective basis to say that those conditions 1 and 2 are correct. And I'm calling upon President Obama, as the chief of the executive branch, to take the action necessary to substantiate or dispel my concerns. And I'll say it here publicly. If my concerns are all dispelled by an Office of Legal Counsel review, he will have my resignation. I'm not the boy crying wolf here, Peter, and I'll put it on the line. Mm-hmm. America's been very good to me. I'll figure it out, but he'll have my resignation. So if the special counsel won't resign in a position of honor, if the other people won't, well, Joe Carson will.
All right, Joe. Well, I want to thank you both for joining me today, and I invite our listeners to scrutinize all of this carefully. And for me, again, the bottom line is that our government has a long and sordid history of not only mistreating whistleblowers and failing to acknowledge the messages that they often desperately send, but also retaliation against those who do stand up and speak the truth. And so I respect both of you guys for what you have done and what you continue to do for people who may follow in your footsteps. And I thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Keep that whistle handy. You never know when you're going to need to blow it. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.